Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's Media Roundtable, we are talking about coverage of refugees and immigrants from the United States to Italy. We will discuss Italy's new government refusal to offer safe harbor to rescue boats carrying hundreds of migrants. Those boats have instead gone to Spain. We will also talk about Italy's new government and the xenophobic comments it is making about immigrants and refugees in Italy. We're also talking about the ongoing widespread outrage over the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents. This is getting international attention. And the question we're all asking is, how are these families going to be reunited? There is still no plan in place. And according to reports, it could take up to a year to reunite these families. Today, we are joined by Eric Regulli. Eric is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. And Eric joins us from Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back on the show.
Great to have you back. We're also joined by Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post covering immigration. And Roque is out with a very disturbing piece called Migrant Children Drugged Without Consent at Government Centers, According to Court Documents. And Roque joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Roque. Thank you for joining us and welcome back.
Sure. My great pleasure.
Well, it's great to have both of you. As we always do on the Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Roque Planas, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Absolutely. It's from a little while back, but there's a really excellent piece in the Texas Observer by a colleague of mine named Melissa Del Bosque called The Surge. And basically what it's about how the Texas state government has invested $2 billion over the last 4 years to assist in immigration enforcement. Now, mind you, by sending DPS troopers and game wardens and other state law enforcement officials to the border, they can't make immigration arrests. But one of the results is that people who live in the area are now constantly getting harassed by the police in a way that wasn't true before. And one of the things that she points out in there is that at the same time, the state's portion of funding for public education dropped from 48 to 38%. Now, I know that the school just up the street, because my partner is a teacher, we're losing special ed positions in a historically Mexican-American neighborhood. So I think it's a really good illustration of how the Texas state government is quite literally taking money out of the barrio and putting it at the border. And you have this obsessive focus at all levels of law enforcement on what is a very dwindling problem of immigration. We have the lowest numbers of illegal apprehensions for border crossings since the 1970s. That's been true for about a decade.
Wow. Well, thank you for that one. And we'll definitely follow the money later in the show because a lot more reporting has come out on that. So we will put that link to that story, The Texas Observer by Melissa Del Bosque. And she's been on the show a few times. Thank you for that, Roque. What about you, Eric? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
What's impressed me this week, Rose, is the number of stories written by foreign correspondents in Italy about the rise of Matteo Salvini in Italy. He is in charge of the immigration file. What's impressive, I guess, to use the word, it may be the wrong word about Salvini, is that he pretty much came out of nowhere. He's not prime minister. He is the founder of the League Party. He's immigration minister, interior minister, but in effect, he's acting like prime minister. He's completely stolen the show in Italy. He's dominating the headlines across Europe, not just in Italy. No one can even remember the name of the new prime minister in Italy. And, I mean, there's any number of stories. I'm just looking at one now by the Financial Times of London. It's by James Politti, and it's a profile of how Matteo Salvini has completely taken over the show. The headline in that story is, "Combative Salvini Seizes Control of Italy's Political Agenda."
Well, since you are bringing this up, Eric, let's dive in and talk about Matteo Salvini. He's just 45, and he's the leader of the right-wing League Party, who is a well-known xenophobe. For people who haven't been following Italian politics, give us a quick overview of this right-wing League Party, and how did they come to power?
Okay, in brief, he came from a party called the Northern League. The Northern League, until very recently, was a secessionist party in northern Italy. They wanted to separate from the rest of Italy. They thought southern Italy was beyond hope. They thought, in essence, that it was part of Africa. They just didn't want to share northern Italy's wealth with it. In fact, Salvini was very rude about southern Italians. In the last, the 2006 World Cup, Salvini was so anti-Italy, he actually cheered, he wouldn't even cheer for the Italian teams. He wanted his own country. Now that's changed. They've become a national party in the last election. He's gone down to southern Italy and apologized, but he actually won very few votes in southern Italy. It was the five-star movement that did very well. Nonetheless, he's a firebrand. He's articulate. He's very good at the sound bite. He's physically imposing, and he is really rising in the polls. He's actually the junior partner in the coalition government, but in effect, he is taking over, and he's seized the most important ministry, which is the Interior Ministry. And also, he's casting doubts about the survival of Europe. He's very much a Eurosceptic. So this is the man who's shaking up the immigration file and really shaking up Italy's relationship with the rest of Europe.
There's some audio that's going around social media. Last year, Matteo Salvini said, quote, "We need a mass cleansing, street by street, piazza by piazza, neighborhood by neighborhood. We need to be tough because there are entire parts of our cities, entire parts of Italy that are out of control." And in that same interview, he suggested that Italy could adopt policies on immigration similar to those of Donald Trump. Roque, we are now seeing a rise in these kinds of politicians and these parties across Europe. And a lot of politicians are talking about Donald Trump and his policies. Roque, I know that you're focused specifically on immigration here in the U.S., but more broadly, what are your thoughts on the media coverage that we're seeing about this right-wing turn in Europe and the connection to Donald Trump and his administration?
Well, I must confess my ignorance to what's going on in Europe, though I have seen some of the reporting. I think that part of what we're seeing is just this broad sort of populist sweep that, to me, has echoes of what's going on here. You know, there's a sort of undercurrent of people, at least in the United States, feeling as though the United States isn't just dealing with a law enforcement issue or an immigration issue, but some sort of national reckoning with their own identity. Donald Trump is someone who got to the presidency by basically affirming this sort of notions of the country's identity back when it was a whiter country and had lower levels of migration. And I certainly see some parallels to what's going on in Europe in that.
Right. And Eric, last week, the Italian government refused to rescue a ship with more than 600 migrants. This got international attention. And Spain agreed to rescue the ship instead. Can you talk about, is Donald Trump getting a lot of attention in the Italian media, given that in this interview, Matteo Salvini said Italy should adopt policies on immigration similar to those of Trump?
Yes, Donald Trump is. I mean, not just for immigration, but also for trade and some other things. But I just on Salvini, that was a huge story last week when he stopped the ship with 600 African migrants, and it was finally accepted by Spain. You got to realize that the Italians as a whole applauded this move. And one of the reasons they applauded it is that the European Union as a whole has done virtually nothing to help Italy, relieve the pressure on Italy. Italy and Greece have been absolutely on the front lines of the migration crisis. Now, I hesitate to use the word crisis. We can talk about that later. But there are 650,000 undocumented migrants in Italy. Most Italians, certainly Salvini, think that's too much. And the fact is, virtually no other country in Europe has helped relieve the pressure on Italy. So when he stopped the ship, yes, I think Salvini is a xenophobe and a racist, but I also know that he was trying to make a statement to the European Union saying, look, enough, you can't stop your borders. France has closed its border, Austria has closed its border, And you can't keep making this problem solely a Greek and Italian problem. You guys got to help out.
Eric, do you think that immigration is one of the main reasons why these right-wing governments are winning across Europe?
Yes, but that's a good question. I think, you know, certainly I covered the German election. The Alternative for Germany, AfD, did very well in the September election of last year, largely because of the migration crisis. But, Rose, when you look at the numbers, I don't know where the migration crisis is. If you look at Italy, for example, there are 61 million inhabitants in Italy. I live in Rome. Italy has 650,000 migrants that have arrived in the last 5 years. That's about 1%. You know, Germany took 1 million plus in 2015. Well, the population of the European Union is 510 million. So I don't see the crisis, and the numbers are falling. The numbers of arrivals this year, so far this year, across the Mediterranean to the European Union, were only 41,000. That's half of last year, which in turn was half of the year before. So these populist parties are being very experts at stoking the flames. I don't see a crisis, but the populist parties are giving the perception there is one.
Hmm. And is it true? So Italy's center-left Democratic Party was completely voted out of power recently?
I'm sorry, please repeat that, Rose. I didn't hear you.
Italy's center-left Democratic Party was completely voted out of power recently?
Yes, in the March election, it was called the Democratic Party under Matteo Salvini. They lost power. They weren't eliminated. They still the third biggest power party. But you know, Rose, even the Democrats were turning against immigration. So they saw what was happening. They read the mood of the voters, but they turned a bit too late, and Salvini and company absolutely stole the show. So migration is probably the number one issue here.
Before we let you go, Eric, the footage of the comments that Salvini made last year are being shared after he announced a, quote, census of the country's Gypsy or Roma community. He said that Italian Gypsies would, quote, unfortunately be allowed to stay in the country while others would be expelled. And according to the reports I've read, Italy is home to between 100,000 and 180,000 Gypsies. How are they treated in Italy? And how did the public respond to these comments about expelling Gypsies who are not Italian?
Well, the Gypsies are treated with absolute contempt. We don't call them Gypsies here. We call them the Roma, R-O-M-A. They're treated with absolute contempt here. There is very little sympathy towards the Roma, whether they're Italian citizens or not. So when I look at the Italian media, I didn't... Some reports were, you know, said this is right out of Mussolini's fascist playbook, where you're taking a census of a specific ethnic group. It's not even constitutional. By and large, though, there is no outrage on the streets in Italy because most Italians don't like the Roma. End of story.
Hmm. Well, Eric, we'd like to do a longer show just about the far-right governments across Europe and how that's being received in the public and what changes you're seeing on the ground. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Bye-bye.
That is Eric Reguli. He's European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, and you can find his reporting about what's happening in Italy and the changes that are happening there at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're also joined by Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post covering immigration. And we were really struck by a piece Roque wrote this week called Migrant Children Drugged Without Consent at Government Centers, According to Documents. Roque, this was just a shocking story. And since your piece came out, there's been a number of pieces in Reveal, in Newsweek. Can you tell us what you found? Staff working on the behalf of the Office of Refugee Resettlement are routinely drugging detained child migrants with psychotropics without their parents' consent. This is according to legal filings. So this is happening at a center in Texas?
Yes, that's correct. And let me just clarify one point really quick. I started looking at these legal filings in the Flores case because they were so central to the family detention coverage that we did from 2014 to 2016, and found this filing and started reporting on it. But I did want to clarify that the reveal actually came out a little bit before us, and we ended up having to rush to catch up, and it is a very, they were working in conjunction with Texas Tribune and actually found someone who was locked up at Shiloh Residential Treatment Center, which is one of the places where these allegations took place. I would definitely urge your readers to or your listeners to check that out too.
To add to that, a reporter named Susan Carroll has been tweeting that she and her colleagues at the Texas Tribune interviewed children detained at Shiloh about medication and abuse in 2014.
Absolutely. And what's going on at Shiloh Residential Treatment Center, according to the legal filings, and this is going back quite some time, right? The filings are from April, and certainly the allegations stem from before that. The lawyers have access to the medical records, and some of these children report being forced to take up to 9 different psychotropics in a single day. These are very potent medicines. Some people that we talked to with mental health expertise really question whether or not most children that are coming into the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement need these kind of medications at all. They have very serious side effects. One child reported gaining 45 pounds in a matter of 6 weeks. So it is very disturbing, and I think it calls into question on totally different grounds the Trump administration's family separation policy, right? Because it's all premised on the notion that the children will be well taken care of. Well, we know that separating the children from their parents is highly traumatizing. We know that many of these children are coming from populations that have been exposed to extreme violence. Many are arriving with PTSD. And so I think what we've seen in these court filings, and they are voluminous, and they also involve the use of physical restraints, tying children to chairs by all four limbs and putting a bag over their heads as punishment when they misbehave. They're very serious, and they raise serious questions about whether or not the government is prepared to handle another 2,300 children that they separated on purpose.
So if these reports came out in 2014, Roque, what has been done as a result?
Some members of Congress, including Sheila Jackson, called for Shiloh Residential Treatment Center to be shut down. It has not. The guy who founded that place has also founded other residential treatment centers where children have died, including one who died while restrained in a closet. I think this raises very serious questions for both state and federal regulators. One of the things that's going on here is that the ORR contracted facilities, or at least in this case, the Shiloh Residential Treatment Center, was exempted from a requirement to document when they administer emergency medicine. So it remains to me unclear why they're offering that kind of dispensation when it's not true for the people that are in state custody.
You write that one child identified in court records as Julio Z said staff at Shiloh threw him to the floor and forced him to take medication. He said he witnessed staff pry another child's mouth open to force him to swallow a pill. And when Julio Z attempted to refuse the medication, he said the doctor ignored him. Julio said, quote, "They told me that if I did not take the medicine, I could not leave. The only way I could get out of Shiloh was if I took the pills," end quote. And then Holly Cooper, one of the lawyers representing the children in the Flores agreement litigation, said that this is not specific to Shiloh. So at this point, Roque, do we know if this is happening in other immigration centers?
Holly seems to think so. And let me just clarify that what happens to these children when they're separated from their parents or when they show up at the border unaccompanied, they are sent to foster care with ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, who then tries to locate sponsors. Most of them go to live with their families, but some wind up in much longer-term care with the government if they exhibit behavior problems or if they can't find a sponsor, or sometimes based on what oftentimes turn out to be specious allegations of gang affiliation from ICE or from Customs and Border Protection. So according to Holly, who has access to medical records from the class members in the lawsuit, this is widespread. At any given time, there are several hundred children that are locked up in some of these longer-term facilities. It is very difficult for the lawyers to get the children out because ORR has a very opaque process by which you protest it. So we don't know the extent of it. The lawyers seem to think that it's very serious and that it's wider spread than is currently documented in the exhibits that were submitted to the court.
After being forced to take the medications, Julio Z reported gaining 45 pounds in just 2 months. A mother of a child identified in court records as Isabella said the medications were so powerful that her daughter repeatedly fell because she could not walk. Is the Trump administration or anyone at the Department of Health and Human Services, is anyone commenting on this?
No, ORR has not commented on anything that we've received. They were at first attentive and then stopped responding to my emails and phone calls a few days ago, and certainly as we were getting ready to publish this report. I think it is definitely very concerning, some of the things that are going on at ORR, and I think it's actually quite sad that it took this family separation policy for people to take a closer look at it, you know, myself included. It's something that I kind of feel bad about over the time that I've been working on unaccompanied minors and family detention issues.
So this is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. I'm guessing I have no idea who is running this or how it runs. Have you been able to find anything? I mean, is someone, you know, so many people working in the Trump administration have absolutely no experience working for these departments. What do we know about who's running this office?
So this office is run currently by a guy named, I believe, Scott Lloyd. We might want to double check that name just to make sure I have it correct, because I'm going from memory. He's been the major place that he came out in the news was because he personally intervened to keep an unaccompanied minor in their custody from trying to get an abortion. In that particular case, he was unsuccessful. But the ORR, the way that it works is that they take charge of the minors. They have different field specialists who make the assessment on whether or not they're going to keep custody of them. But here's the thing, and I think this is part of what makes it complex and very disturbing. By U.S. law, under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, right, ORR is actually the one who is responsible for funding the legal services. And this creates a big conflict, because when a lawyer wants to seriously challenge some of these opaque decisions about them not releasing a child with either severe mental health issues or what have you to a parent, right, they get scared to file a habeas or some other lawsuit to try to get them out, because they don't want to antagonize ORR and lose their access to the children altogether. It's very, I think, disturbing that the system is set up this way.
Roque, at this point, what do we know about how these families will be reunited? I mean, so many social workers, doctors, psychiatrists who have been going to the border to try to get into some of these centers say in their experience, it could take months, even more than a year, to reunite these families. I heard one report involving a mother who had to take 4 saliva tests to prove that this particular girl or boy is her child.
That's correct. And I think one of the most disturbing things is that if you look at the Florida's litigation, they actually, the lawyers in that lawsuit, have been asking ICE since way before the family detention policy, or ORR and DHS, to find a better plan and submit it to the court to facilitate communication between the kids and their parents, right? So this is a longstanding problem. The government implemented a family separation policy with absolutely no plan to reunite the kids with their parents. We still haven't seen that they have a workable plan. We have seen from some reports that some parents are getting deported without their children. And in some cases, well, I think in most cases, unaccompanied minors actually have a much easier pathway to citizenship through things like special immigrant juvenile status and so forth. So in some cases, these separations could be permanent. It's very disturbing, and I think it's something that there's a lot of public pressure for the government to come up with. And I mean, to my mind, just knowing that they've been asked to do this for months, including even before it became a public issue, only should heighten the level of scrutiny that they're getting.
The New York Times had a piece about Elsa Johanna Ortiz, who fled Guatemala, traveled to Mexico with her 8-year-old son, Anthony, and the Border Patrol was waiting as they made their way to the border on May 26th. The mom and son were in a detention center in southern Texas, and then everything happened so fast. Anthony, her son, was sent to a migrant shelter. She was put on a plane back to Guatemala without her son. And she's been speaking to reporters over Skype, I believe, and she says she's completely devastated. The piece is called "I Cannot Go Without My Son," a mother pleads as she was deported to Guatemala without her child. Do we have any idea, Roque, how many parents have been deported without their children?
We don't know yet. I mean, it's one of the many things that I think reporters are trying to figure out. I think one of the things that again, is raising a lot of questions. It sounds like there's confusion within the bureaucracy about whether or not they know. There's confusion within the bureaucracy about how they're tracking people. And there's confusion within the bureaucracy about what the executive order that Donald Trump signed in order to change this system even actually means. So I think we will hopefully get answers within the coming weeks. But, you know, right now, that's all I can say, that it looks like the level of bureaucratic confusion that was created by this hastily crafted policy is very extreme.
Roque Planas is a national reporter for the Huffington Post covering immigration. You can find one of his latest pieces, Migrant Children Drugged Without Consent at Government Centers, according to documents at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation, on the phone, by sending an email to yourcall@klw.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A, an additional Friday news roundup heading your way, as well as the international response to Trump's immigration policy. That's coming up 1A at 11 here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about coverage of what's happening at the border, specifically children who are being separated from their parents. We're joined by Roque Planas, national reporter with the Huffington Post covering immigration. Roque will be with us for about 20 more minutes. And if you have any questions or comments about this, it's getting international attention. There's so much outrage. For once, the media are not focusing on Donald Trump's tweets. He is not dictating the news. They are actually going to the border and doing very excellent reporting on what is happening. I mean, we can't even keep up with all the news that's coming out. Roque, you have another very disturbing piece. Migrant children report physical verbal abuse in at least 3 federal detention centers. Migrant kids as young as 11 have reported suffering physical and verbal abuse from staff in at least 3 separate child detention centers after being apprehended at the border, according to multiple lawsuits. Can you tell us about this? You wrote about affidavits submitted to the court in 2 lawsuits last year and this year.
Yes, absolutely. So again, with the children who are in OR custody, sometimes they get sent to secured facilities. And in this case, there are a couple that have come up in affidavits alleging pretty widespread abuse. One is Shenandoah in Virginia, the other one's Yolo County. Some of these children have described getting called wetbacks. They're in the same facilities as people that are there in state custody, and they report staff saying things like, the federal kids or the migrant children who are in separate custody or who are isolated are there because they had raped someone or they have HIV. Some of the kids have reported getting strapped by all limbs to a chair and put with bags over their heads, one for as many as 8 hours, another who urinated on himself because they wouldn't let him get up. it's extremely disturbing, particularly when you imagine that, like I said earlier, we're talking about a population that has very severe, you know, mental health trauma by the time that they arrive here. Many of the kids were witnesses to extreme violence in Central America. Many of them were jumped into gangs. Some of them are arriving with PTSD, and now they're also separated from their families. So I think, again, this is something that I would hope is going to spur some very intense scrutiny from state and federal regulators.
You report that some of these kids describe cutting themselves or attempting suicide.
That's correct, yeah. There were incidents of self-harm. There are incidents of suicide attempts. They're all contained within the affidavits and these lawsuits.
Roque, let's give this story a little bit of context, because so much of the coverage has been on the separation of the families. And they are fleeing countries that have some of the highest murder rates in the world: Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, some of the highest femicide rates in the world. We're talking about domestic violence, but also threats against women. And can you, I mean, what mechanisms are in place, for example, in Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras, if a woman is threatened by a partner? What can she do?
That I can't tell you with a degree of specificity about what law enforcement is actually supposed to do. I can tell you that in the years that I've been reporting on family detention, which began on a large scale under the Obama administration in 2014, it's very common for women to say that they were abused by domestic partners or abused by people in the neighborhood, sometimes associated with gangs. I'm talking very serious sexual abuse, talking very serious violence, and that their attempts to go to the police to get things resolved did not work. That's part of the reason why you are seeing people in such large numbers come to the United States, right? Because the first thing that people do, I think people sort of have a false notion that that people are coming here seeking a better life, and that's true in a sort of vague sense. But more often than not, what people try to do first is just move to a different town or get away from an abusive partner. Doesn't always work, right? I mean, I think coming to the United States for most of these people is an absolute last resort.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, the mechanisms that are in place to protect people are just simply not there. I mean, it's like, for many practical purposes, the state in El Salvador, and Guatemala, and Honduras is very broken.
And sometimes these kids are forced into gangs. The gangs threaten that they'll either kill the child or kill the family. And Carrie Kahn, who's NPR's international correspondent in Mexico City, was on this week, and she's done extensive reporting on this, and she said so many times these families are literally running with nothing. And it takes the average family about 1 month to get from Honduras or El Salvador to the U.S. border. And
that's another
it's another important aspect of this story, because that experience is traumatizing enough.
That's correct. We've certainly spoken with people who have made this journey over the years, and it's extremely difficult. A lot of times people are putting themselves in the hands of human smugglers, or putting their children in the hands of human smugglers, and they're very, very much vulnerable to abuse. I mean, and I think one of the things that you did on the show that I think is really good for your listeners to hear is to sort of set this in a global context, mm-hmm. right? Because I think we see what's happening in front of us, but we don't necessarily see the larger picture, right? For five centuries, right, Europeans went wherever they wanted to and colonized three quarters of the globe. And then you have the 19th and 20th centuries, where you have the United States and Britain economically colonizing much of the globe, and then the Cold War, which destroyed governing institutions across the Third World, right? So I think part of what we're seeing is a reckoning of that globally, not just in the United States, not just in Italy, right? But when you have all of the wealth flowing in one direction, right, to the global north, and you have broken governing institutions back in the global south, the result is that people are going to want to come here.
Exactly. And then you also have the United States support for dictators. You have the School of the Americas, which trained various factions in those countries. And then you've got trade policies like NAFTA. And then you have corrupt governments, failed states in Honduras, El Salvador. So there's so many other aspects to this. Do you feel like this kind of historical context is making its way into these reports that you've been seeing over the last 2 weeks?
I think you see it sometimes. I think right now, the news media, and this is a recurring theme under Donald Trump, right, is very preoccupied with what is happening right in front of them, because there's so much, and particularly when you're talking about immigration, there's so much, and there's so many reporters that don't necessarily have a background in immigration, and they've had to be drafted by newsrooms to do this because it's the urgent issue of the day. And I think that by and large, the news media response has been very positive, especially when you look at what's going on in D.C. You had people with this family separation policy, you know, lying through their teeth, trying to figure out a way to exculpate President Trump for creating it. You know, I'm talking about Senator Paul Ryan, who blamed the family separation on a court order. I'm talking about DHS Secretary Nielsen, who denied that the policy existed at all. And I think you saw very quickly the D.C. press corps catch on that this wasn't quite true and started really going aggressively. And I think that it was really good, you know, because it's not the immigration law is extremely complicated. The historical context is extremely complicated. But that's where we're at today. I mean, I think incorporating that kind of historical context is difficult to do in a context where you have just rapid fire, mass, crazy, bureaucratically confusing changes. But I do hope that in the future we can get there and that people can sort of understand what's going on. And I think one more thing that I'd like to add to that is that the characteristics of immigration have changed profoundly in the last decade. It's no longer about Mexicans coming to the United States seeking short-term work the way that it was in the 80s and the 90s. Mm. Right now it is primarily Central American families and children seeking humanitarian relief. So this is something, and the numbers are low. The numbers are as low as they were in the 1970s, in the early 1970s, right? So this is something that could be addressed with a narrow solution in Congress that if people would come to the table could involve some sort of trade-off between allowing more legal avenues to get people here through legal ports of entry or by applying in their home country. But I don't think that you can enforce your way out of it because people are leaving because they face great distress.
Well, and then just briefly, Roque, and we're going to do much more reporting on this. There's a lot of money involved in all of this. NBC News is reporting that it costs about $775 a night for each child in these migrant detention centers. The Nation has a piece by David Dayan, how private contractors enable Trump's cruelties at the border. Private prison groups and several Fortune 500 companies are profiting off of, quote, zero tolerance enforcement. So a lot of these contractors are making a lot of money off of these detention centers and these kids.
That's absolutely true. And I think one other thing that people may not be as quick to realize, right, through zero tolerance prosecutions of criminal immigration violations, which are entirely redundant because we have a civil process to deal with people's immigration cases, right? But this was costing, as of about 2012, 2013, $1 billion in incarceration costs alone. Mm. That does not count public defenders, because people who face criminal immigration charges need a lawyer under U.S. law. The CJA attorneys, who are even more expensive. It doesn't account for the prosecutors and the judges who have to carry out these cases, all so that they can prosecute a redundant misdemeanor at as close to 100% as possible. That is a flagrant misuse of scarce prosecutorial resources. And on top of it creates an embedded system where you have a lot of people, including people who work on the public payroll, who now have an incentive to keep doing something that does nothing to reduce crime in this country and is entirely redundant.
Is this executive order going to change anything for these children, Roque? The Trump executive order that he just signed?
It looks as though in the short term it will largely halt the actual separations between mothers and children, right, and parents and children. Long term, we really don't know what it does because it's not workable the way that it's currently written. You cannot detain families for longer than 20 days under a 2015 court order in the Florida settlement litigation, right? And that is the same case through which these allegations of forcible drugging and of physical abuse came out, right? So until they can get that ruling overturned, and there's definitely no guarantee that that will happen because the judge in charge of that case has not been sympathetic to those efforts in the past, right? But until that happens, they can't really detain families indefinitely, and that's their plan. So it remains to be seen what the effect is gonna be. There seems to have been a halt in the zero tolerance policy as applied to parents. We don't know if that's just a temporary halt because they didn't know if they could or not. I think that's probably the most likely explanation. But it, like I said, it remains to be seen. I think that right now what's looking the most likely is that the government is going to try to put families into military facilities or contracted facilities, which could be very easily a massively expensive debacle, which is what we saw during the Obama administration. They hastily constructed and expanded family detention centers at a cost of over $1 billion over a few years. And then what happened? They got an adverse court ruling, and they turned into very, very expensive holding centers. And that's where we're at now. We'll see if Congress steps in. I'm not particularly hopeful that they're going to come up with any kind of workable solution.
Right. The military has been asked to provide 20,000 beds for detained immigrant children. We will continue to follow this. Roque, thank you for all of your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Roque Planas is national reporter with the Huffington Post covering immigration. And now I would like to welcome Kevin Hall to the show. Kevin is chief economics correspondent and senior investigative reporter with McClatchy Papers. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Kevin, we're going to talk with you about the Panama Papers, but first I just want to ask you, how long have you been a reporter in D.C.?
In D.C., I came back from overseas around 2005.
And then you have reported from overseas. What do you make of what's happening right now? I mean, the information that we're learning about not only children being separated from their families, but children enduring they're being forced to take psychotropic drugs. They're being punched, kicked. Sexual abuse reports are coming out from the ACLU. And we're now learning that some of these children are cutting themselves and trying to commit suicide.
It's interesting because I've covered that issue for a number of years. I used to cover the entire 2,000-mile border, and in 2006, 2007, I did a series of stories where I actually accompanied a coyote taking people across Nogales, Mexico, into Nogales, Arizona. In interviewing the people who were being led, the people who were leading them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a new issue. What's striking is the fact that this is being portrayed as a new phenomenon when, in fact, the numbers in real terms are actually down. But the phenomenon has continued for roughly 40 years, and it traces all the way back to the Bracero program. And it's heartbreak. Heartbreak has been around before, and back in 2006, the reason I had been looking at it was you had the Bush administration tightening policy, which was forcing people to take less risks going back to Mexico and Central America and instead paying someone to move their kids instead of them taking their kids. So you still had kids dying in the desert, and that still happens. It happened. And in this case, you've got entire families arguably being drawn because of the tightening of the border, the fear that if they don't do it now, they may not be able to do it later. So you've got all these different push and pulls going. It's a very complex issue.
And Kevin, since you have reported on this for decades, what are the main differences we see between how this all works under Republican administrations versus Democratic administrations?
Well, my colleague here, Frank Ordonez, had a very strong piece this week that outlined how a lot of this actually began under the Obama administration, which Republicans are quick to point to. But in fact, if you're honest about it, it was being done because they were being beaten around the head and shoulders politically for being soft. So it was in a response to what was pressure from the other side and trying to have some continuity in a policy that began under Bush in earnest. You could argue it began under Clinton with the North American Free Trade Agreement because this was a push and pull issue with the NAFTA as well, and one of the ideas behind NAFTA that Mr. Trump wants to tear up or redo was basically to create jobs in Mexico so there wouldn't be this pressure to come to the United States seeking work.
What do you think explains the outrage? I mean, I have to say it's fantastic to see the cable shows and broadcast media not focus on Trump's tweets. For the first time in a long time, he's not dictating the news. They're actually doing real on-the-ground reporting. So if this has been going on, what do you think explains every media outlet doing excellent reporting on this issue?
Oh, I think an image is worth a thousand words, right? I mean, I think the tapes that Ginger Thompson got out with ProPublica, I think it happened in a way. This had been going on to an extent, but it wasn't organized. It was in a way that didn't lag with these long periods, and it wasn't a tactical move. And I think that's the distinction. Attorney General Sessions says this wasn't the case, when in fact he earlier had warned, we're going to take your kids away from you. And it was, and it's ample evidence that senior advisor Stephen Miller had actually been pushing this since the start of the Trump administration to use separation as a tactic, as a disincentive, or as a threat for people coming to the border. So I think all of those things kind of gelled, and I think that even though if it had happened in a small amount, you already had a lawsuit that required 20 days, you know, limited 20 days of incarceration for children and all that. My recollection along the border is a lot of times kids got pushed back into Mexico and given to aid agencies who did great work, but there were cases of abuse as well.
Well, thank you so much for bringing in that context, because it's so important to bring in the history. And it's not like this just started happening under Donald Trump. The difference is a lot of people under the Trump administration are more vile and openly racist than last administrations.
Without a doubt.
Right.
That's not disputable.
Right. Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent and senior investigative reporter with McClatchy. Kevin, we wanted to bring you on to talk about the latest information we're getting from the massive Panama Papers leaks. This was based on 11.5 million secret files revealing that hundreds of very wealthy individuals and politicians were connected to offshore companies, and they had their wealth in 21 tax havens. Just quickly, can you remind us how journalists, and you were part of the team of journalists, got a hold of these leaked documents?
Well, how they got a hold of it is never really been completely revealed, but Süddeutsche Zeitung, the German newspaper, received a leak of a small amount of data, which grew into a flood of data, and then had happened again, where they got this new data that covers a period now between roughly April 2016 when publication all the way through December 2017. That was shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, which then put together a team around the world. Originally, it was 379 journalists from more than 100 news organizations. It was about 100 journalists this time out. 1.2 million documents in the new leak, and it shows what the company and its customers did as the veil of secrecy was kind of snatched away.
What do the new documents reveal?
Kind of more of the same to some degree, but new names, the brother of the former prime minister of Malaysia, some Kuwaiti royal family members. Those are kind of the bigger new names. Nazarbayev's daughter, the longtime ruler of Kazakhstan. So a little bit more of the same in that sense, but the real revelation is how little Mossack Fonseca knew about who the true owners of these shell companies were. And again, the United States spends a lot of time and effort trying to combat drug trafficking, money laundering, terror financing, and then a group like Mossack Fonseca, you know, has got hundreds of thousands of shell companies, and their internal record keeping as they're trying to figure out what to do as the walls are caving in on them, they realize that they have less, roughly 70% of their customers, they don't know who they are. You know, it's a strike. And then the question for policymakers should be, well, is this group an outlier, or if you manage to have a leak at Morgan & Morgan or one of the other big offshore providers, would it look the same? And nobody seems to be asking that important question.
You report that the law firm Mossack Fonseca shows that it's scrambling to contain the crisis triggered by the leak of the Panama Papers and attempting to field demands for information from authorities in a number of countries, with the glaring exception of the United States.
Right. Now, it doesn't mean that the U.S. hasn't been looking at it other ways, but it's pretty striking when the Germans, the British, everybody is writing the regulators in the Seychelles and the British Virgin Islands and British Anguilla, and they're asking, hey, send us information, send us, you know, here's a subpoena, we want these documents about this guy. And none of the above. And there were a lot of Americans in here. There was a perception that Americans were not in the Panama Papers. There wasn't a Vladimir Putin-type American with a big name. But all the guys you think would benefit from anonymity, pump-and-dump schemes on Wall Street, hedge funds, a lot of financial fraudsters, Bitcoin fraud, all that stuff is in there. And there seems to be a great incuriosity on the part of our regulators.
Also, you report that as Senator Claire McCaskill, a U.S. senator from Missouri, said she supports cracking down on offshore tax havens, but her husband, Joseph Shepard, is an investor in Matrix Capital Management, and that earned between $230,000 and $2.1 million in income since he first invested in 2013. He has invested $1 million in that hedge fund, and it's tied to the Cayman Islands, one of the world's most notorious tax havens. Tell us about this. What else did you find?
Well, that my colleague Lindsay Wise did most of the digging on that, but they found, you know, going through the financial filings, that in fact he had been part of this Matrix Capital, which is, without boring your listeners, it's called a feeder fund. It's a structure that hedge funds use to take U.S. investment, feed it through the Cayman Islands, so it gets the benefits of less regulation and lower cost structure. They would still pay on it, but, you know, most Americans don't realize, I think, that the biggest way the very wealthy are different than the rest of us is they don't earn income like we do on wages. They earn it, their money comes from investment income, which is taxed at a much lower rate. And then you throw that on top and have these folks invest in a structure that goes through the Cayman Islands to make it even more of a profit margin for them versus, you know, your 401k that, you know, invests in the tracks the S&P 500 or something like that. So it's kind of that structure. And one of the questions we have, and at the risk of tipping my hat to competitors, you know, there's so little disclosed required in disclosure of congressional forms. We're not sure how this compares to others. We were looking at her because she's the senator from one of our papers, but I don't think she's unique in that the Senate tends to be full of wealthier people, and the hedge funds that her husband was invested in are limited. You know, have to have $1 million or more just to get into the fund. So this is not for the average guy. They're for sophisticated investors. And goes to the heart of transparency, income inequality, fairness, and all those other questions.
Right, because it's all connected.
Yep.
Is there anything citizens can do to pressure politicians to actually take up this issue just quickly, Kevin?
Ask for greater disclosure. Demand greater disclosure. We've got a president who won't release his taxes, and then you have, you know, Congress, senators and Congress people who disclose only broad ranges and very little detail.
Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent and senior investigative reporter with McClatchy. As always, thank you for your reporting. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.